Yesterday, the Senate stepped back from the edge of a partisan clash over President Obama's executive branch nominees. So what does not going nuclear mean for work in the Senate? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll talk about the significance of the filibuster deal. Also, why Microsoft wants you to know more about the NSA's customer data requests. And will immigration reform be step-by-step or comprehensive? And an Iowa couple honored at the White House for nonprofit outreach. Our analysts this hour, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. Join our discussion for this Politics Wednesday after the news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday on the program. We're so glad to have with us Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College, joining us by phone. Wayne Moyer, welcome back to the program.
Ben, it's a pleasure to be here.
Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa in our Iowa City studio. Tim Hagel.
Hey there.
Hey, thank you for coming in today. Plenty to talk about, to chew over. This week, we've got the Snowden affair, the next chapter on that, perhaps the impact on U.S.-Russian relations. Also, why Microsoft wants you to know more about the NSA's consumer data requests, Trayvon Martin, repercussions on that verdict, questions about stand-your-ground laws in various states. Also, toward the end of the program, we'll mention an Iowa couple honored at the White House for its their nonprofit outreach. In fact, they'll be on the program Friday of this week, but let's jump into the biggest political news of the last few hours. The Senate struck a deal yesterday avoiding a so-called nuclear option, which would have changed the rules of the Senate. Majority Democrats were seeking an up or down vote on President Obama's nominees, many of which have been blocked by a filibuster. And while many praised the deal, Iowa's Democratic Senator Tom Harkin voiced support for changing the filibuster rules as they apply to nominees, an idea he says he's supported while serving in both the majority and the minority in the Senate.
Any president should have his or her right to put their team in place by a majority vote of the advice and consent of the United States Senate. Thoroughly vetted, committee hearings, answering questions, yes, but an up or down vote with a majority vote in the United States Senate. That is the only deal that will get us out of this trap we find ourselves in. It's the only thing, I think, that will reassure the American people that once again the United States Senate is going to function. It's going to do its job. It's not going to be thwarted by a handful of people, or one or two or three or four people, and that we can actually move this country ahead and let this president, the next president who may be a Republican, yes, let that president have his team.
Senator Harkin there talking about the filibuster deal. Wayne Moyer, let me ask you, comment, if you like, on Senator Harkin's comments there, but also on the significance of the way this showdown ended for now.
Well, I agree with Senator Harkin that the president has a right to put people on in for his government departments, his cabinet, in place. But if you do away with the filibuster, there may be some other consequences. One problem that I see with doing away completely with the filibuster is you could get really radical changes in policy as the Senate moves from one party to the other policy. So you may lose some policy consistency that you have now. Now, granted, progress in the Senate is glacial, but is that better or worse than radical changes?
Mm-hmm.
There would be a cost to doing away with the filibuster, and even though I think it was a mistake to hold up the president's cabinet nominees or his appointments.
Mm-hmm. Well, before I turn to Tim Hagel on this very same question, let's make sure our listeners are aware. You can join in our conversation on this point. What do you think of the filibuster in the Senate? Is it a valuable tool or an obstruction for an administration trying to get things done. 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Tell us your view, Tim Hagel.
Well, I would disagree with Senator Harkin to the extent that it's one or two or a handful of people that are, in his view, blocking these current nominations or others in the past, that it's going to be 41 because you had to get to 60 votes. And that kind of goes along with what Wayne was saying in terms of the idea of the Senate being a deliberative body and that it's not going to have these radical changes. And Senator Harkin, of course, as he indicated, was part of the majority, part of the minority for a period too, and part of the minority when the minority Democrats were blocking a lot of George W. Bush's nominees. I followed the court, so I was particularly aware of some of the ones in the courts, but there were others as well. So it works both ways, and as Wayne was suggesting, that can help to slow down and require more consensus. But under certain circumstances, it can also be seen as a block. So it may be a matter of whether you see the particular policies of whoever happens to be president at the time as good or bad as to whether you like or dislike the filibuster.
Now, the deal paves the way that was reached yesterday, paves the way for the confirmation of five of President Obama's executive branch nominees and the expedited consideration of two more named Tuesday. Republicans won the withdrawal of two nominees for the National Labor Relations Board. They were recess appointments last year. They are under Supreme Court review. So, Tim Hagel, what was accomplished in this deal? Is this a Band-Aid, or does this mark some kind of new era in the Senate of one party actually talking to the other?
Well, my first thought to that is a wonderful tweet that Senator Cruz of Texas sent out, where this deal gives Republicans the opportunity to surrender later. Which basically means that they're saving face in the sense that the two National Labor Relations Board nominees that were basically told that their appointment was unconstitutional because the Senate wasn't in recess, that they're not going to be put up again for nomination. So in that sense, the Republicans save face. But President Obama, as I saw some liberal folks tweet out today, can appoint somebody even more liberal than those two. And so it's not really a victory in that sense for the Republicans.
Do you see it then as a victory for the Democrats? Harry Reid, by reports, was pretty jubilant.
He was. And one of the things that I liked that he said was he talked about how sitting down with all of the senators that you started to see the other person's point of view a little bit more. And, you know, especially Republicans can think that they lost the battle. But to a certain extent, if you can get the dialogue going between the parties a little bit more, that comity, COMITY, that may help down the road in terms of avoiding some of these fights or perhaps keeping them from going to that cliff that we occasionally talk about.
Mm-hmm. Let's address what Senator Harkin said there. So what are your thoughts on why we need so much consensus on presidential appointments? Why not a simple majority? Why shouldn't a president be allowed to appoint whomever he wants or she wants? Do you want to tackle that one, Wayne Moyer?
Well, I myself, in terms of cabinet appointments, I think a simple majority is enough. I think it's a little different in the case of judges in federal courts where they have lifetime appointments. But I think the president has a right to have his own people, at least in terms of his cabinet. On the other hand, a large majority of support gives the person that's coming into office, even a cabinet member, more of a basis for operations. If he starts with just a bare majority of support, he's going to be under fire almost immediately. And with a stronger vote in favor of them, it's likely to give him more flexibility, and he'll be under less attack earlier.
Now, the Senate voted to end a two-year Republican blockade of what was preventing Richard Cordray from winning confirmation as director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. He's since, I believe, won confirmation from the full Senate. Remind us why this was so contentious, Tim Hagel.
Well, in the minds of most Republicans, it wasn't so much Cordray himself. It was more that they don't particularly care for that body, that they see it as the director, whoever it is going to be, is going to have too much power, that there's insufficient amount of congressional oversight. And as a result, they didn't want to see that in giving more power to an administration, maybe taking less power, taking power away from Congress in terms of the oversight aspect, to an administration that they see that has already overreached in a variety of ways.
Mm-hmm. And this has some baggage along with this, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. I believe the Bureau meant to be the first director originally of it, Elizabeth Warren, now Senator Warren, Wayne Moyer. So this has been a thorn in a long time for the Republicans, hasn't it?
It's been a long haul. But I think regardless of what you think of the law, it is in place, and let's see how well we can make it work. And there's no way that you can make it work, I think, for the long term without having a director in place. And so I think this is a very positive move in that direction.
1-866-780-9100 if you'd like to join our conversation on this Politics Wednesday with Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College and Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. Mike is joining us from Coralville. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I was just liking to bring up the fact that we've seen maybe one filibuster in recent memory, and that was from Rand Paul on a completely different subject.
An actual stand-on-the-floor filibuster, right. Yes.
Yeah. We've heard almost nothing about the specifics of why these candidates aren't viable for the Republican Party, and it's just a blanket ban. We're not hearing anything coming out about why exactly they're inappropriate or why they can't get confirmed. It's just, will it make to 60 votes? If not, then we won't even bring them up.
Mm-hmm. And so why is that, Wayne Moyer, that we can not actually have a filibuster, just the threat of a filibuster that stops things in its tracks?
Well, I think that's just a question of the Senate rules. If the Senate wanted to, it could actually require people to speak on the floor. But if we did have people speaking from the floor, and we've had in the past some really long filibusters, 10, 12 hours, that sort of thing, that would slow the Senate down even more than it already is with similar results. So I think that's the downside.
Yeah, but we look up to it. Mr. Smith goes to Washington, don't we, standing there speaking his piece until he gets his way, right?
Yes.
All right. 1-866-780-9100. Before we move on, the filibuster deal, any more comments on that, Tim Hagel, before what you're looking forward to here from the Senate as we move on from that showdown?
Well, just one follow-up on what you folks were just saying is that, you know, in a sense, it makes sense to not require the senators to actually go through the process of a real filibuster like Rand Paul did a short time ago. On the other hand, if you actually did make them go through that process, you might have fewer threats to the filibuster. So there's, mm-hmm. I think there's a bit of a trade-off there.
Yeah. 1-866-780-9100. Let's move on to the other news that we had within the last week. We had U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder speaking out against so-called Stand Your Ground laws at an NAACP conference in Florida this week. His words come on the heels of a not guilty verdict for George Zimmerman, the Florida man accused of shooting and killing Trayvon Martin. Florida's Stand Your Ground law was a chief part of Zimmerman's defense and a law that Holder says should be examined.
Separate and apart from the case that has drawn the nation's attention, it's time to question laws that senselessly expand the concept of self-defense and sow dangerous conflict in our neighborhoods. These laws try to fix something that was never broken. There has always been a legal defense for using deadly force if, and the if is important, if no safe retreat is available. But we must examine laws that take this further by eliminating the common sense and age-old requirement that people who feel threatened have a duty to retreat outside their home if they can do so safely. By allowing and perhaps encouraging violent situations to escalate in public, such laws undermine public safety. The list of resulting tragedies is long and unfortunately has victimized too many who are innocent. It is our collective obligation. We must stand our ground to ensure that our laws reduce violence and take a hard look at laws that contribute to more violence than they prevent.
Okay, that was Eric Holder at an NAACP conference in Florida this week. Tim Hagel, first of all, the defense that Zimmerman put forward, I understand, it wanted to sort of help us understand better the basis of the defense, how it relates to the Stand Your Ground law in Florida.
Right. As far as the defense case, it really didn't focus on Stand Your Ground. It was more the self-defense portion. But as many have noted, in the instructions that the judge gave to the jurors, it was mentioned there. Now, I didn't hear all of that one juror, B37, I think it was, with her interview, how much she said they relied on Stand Your Ground. So the jurors could have certainly discussed it. But this really wasn't as much of a situation of a Stand Your Ground as it was self-defense, although that can sort of look at, well, if we knew how the confrontation took place, and of course we don't know for sure because Zimmerman, although they introduced a lot of video, he didn't take the stand, and of course Trayvon Martin is dead and couldn't speak for himself. So we only sort of know that at some point Zimmerman ended up on the ground with, and there's some variance as far as the evidence is concerned, but his head being apparently slammed into the concrete was what his claim was. At that point, it's more of a self-defense than a Stand Your Ground. The Stand Your Ground would have taken effect a little bit earlier when maybe Trayvon, if this is what happened, if he confronted Zimmerman, maybe said, well, why are you following me? And whatever happened then, that would have been more of a Stand Your Ground situation.
Mm-hmm. There are 30 states that have passed down Stand Your Ground laws, limiting the duty to retreat before using deadly force in self-defense. Where does Iowa stand there, Tim?
You know, I'm not sure.
Okay. Do you know Wayne Moyer?
I think it's been introduced, but I don't believe that it's been passed. But I could be wrong on that.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Toby in Iowa City. Hi, Toby. Welcome to our program.
Hello.
Yes.
I can actually answer the question. I have read Title 16, Chapter 704, which is where it is. We don't have a Stand Your Ground. We actually have two situations that are named for when you do not have to retreat: when you're in your dwelling and when you're in your place of business or employment.
Okay,
which is interesting because some states have being in your car mentioned. We don't.
Mm-hmm. And I think the public law is anywhere where you belong, where you may be, you can stand your ground.
Interesting thing. See, Holder talked about half of Stand Your Ground. And my call is actually mostly a plea to everyone, especially in the media, because the Press Citizen did a editorial 2 days ago where they stated their opinion, but they actually didn't say anything about what the law is now and what would be proposed, so it wasn't particularly helpful. There are two halves to Stand Your Ground. One half, which is what Holder was referring to, was expanding the areas where you don't have to retreat. Again, almost every state has house and place of business. Some add your car and things like that. Some add, you know, common walkways and things like that. That's one of the questions. You should know what your state's law is for when you need to. And when you don't, that's just, you should know that, especially if you have a concealed carry or something. But the other half of Stand Your Ground, which is not getting talked about enough, is immunity from arrest, prosecution, and or lawsuit for self-defense shooting. That is something that Florida has as well. And I think when you say 30 states have Stand Your Ground, I think you're actually referring to that part. That's the scarier one.
Okay.
The scarier one, where a person knows that as long as they can put up a viable self-defense story, they can't be arrested, they can't be prosecuted, they can't even be sued for what they do. And I would be terrified if we added that here. I could almost stomach us expanding the regions where you can stand your ground, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
You're not obligated to retreat. But this business about being immune from arrest, prosecution, or lawsuit for just making the argument that it was self-defense, that's Wild West.
Okay, Toby, it sounds like law is more than just your hobby, perhaps.
It is actually just a hobby. I do not have a JD. Don't take anything I said seriously. Don't sue me.
Toby, thanks for your call from Iowa City. Passionate call. Comment. Tim Hagel on what Toby had to say.
Yeah, and this comes into the Florida situation because if I wasn't following the trial all that closely, given how it was on wall-to-wall in some places. But they didn't go through what was called an immunity hearing, which is what the caller was talking about, where if they had had that initial hearing and if Zimmerman had made the case, then they wouldn't have had the trial. And the defense elected to not request that, so they had the trial. Now, what may come into play if there's a civil suit of some point, but I think that from the defense's point of view, that they thought they had a strong case or that the prosecution had a weak case, and so they said, well, we want to get this resolved, because if in fact it had gone to an immunity trial and if it had been resolved in Zimmerman's favor, then there would have been even more outrage than there is at the acquittal.
In the couple minutes that we have before we take a break, Wayne Moyer, I wonder if we could broaden this out to the reflections on the wider debate over race in this country that the Trayvon Martin case has inflamed.
Well, one let me just raise one question here. The federal civil rights sort of intervening in criminal cases inside states was produced and legislated in a very different time period, when it was not possible to get state courts to convict people in racial cases. The political situation has changed dramatically in these states, and these states themselves now have laws, and their judicial systems in general do protect racial minorities better than they did in the 1960s, for instance. And so sort of federal interference in or federal getting into state cases, I think, raises questions now that would not have been raised in the 1960s or in the era when it was not possible to get a fair trial inside a state.
Mm-hmm. Does the federal government have any authority over whether states pass and implement such laws?
Well, the laws that can be declared unconstitutional in a federal court if they, in fact, are inconsistent with the U.S. Constitution, or even federal laws can take supremacy over state laws if the Supreme Court determines that the state doesn't have the appropriate power.
Mm-hmm. Now, Eric Holder, to be clear, we heard that clip from him, but he's insisted that he wasn't commenting on the case, which is, as you mentioned, under investigation by the Justice Department for a possible civil rights prosecution. However, the Attorney General his message was he views that stand your ground measures are unwisely provocative.
Well, what's interesting about that is I saw some data that some reporter put together that was part of a database that the Tampa Bay, I forget what the paper is, had, where in fact blacks took advantage of the stand your ground defense much more. Like about 25%, which is twice what their percentage in the population was, and they won about half of those cases. So they may have benefited from that law more than, on a percentage-wise at least, than whites did.
We'll be back in just a moment with more of Politics Wednesday here. Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, and when we come back, we'll talk about fugitive U.S. intelligence leaker Edward Snowden and the impact he may have on U.S.-Russia relations. Also, why Microsoft wants you to know more about the NSA's customer data requests, and an Iowa couple honored at the White House for nonprofit outreach. We'll come back in just a moment. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. River to River from Iowa Public Radio News continues. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and it's Politics Wednesday with Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, our political analysts for this week. We hope you'll join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Plenty of topics to march through, get some thoughts on yet this half hour. Coming up later on, we'll talk about Egypt, what's been happening there. We heard this week that there's an upstart effort that's joining getting some more momentum to remove the chain of command from military sexual assault cases. Senator Grassley involved or chiming in on that. We'll hear that in a moment. But first, let's talk about this longstanding story, international story. Fugitive U.S. intelligence leaker Edward Snowden has applied for temporary asylum in Russia. The Federal Migration Service in Russia confirmed he had completed the relevant paperwork at Moscow's airport, where he has been for the past 3 weeks. Snowden is wanted by the U.S. for leaking details of government surveillance programs. He has no travel documents, so he has been unable to take up asylum offers from a number of Latin American states. Again, the U.S. White House reiterated its position that the fugitive should be expelled and face trial in the U.S. I wonder, Wayne Moyer, how this might impact relations with Russia. I saw, for instance, this morning in the news, Senator Lindsey Graham telling NBC News, I guess this was yesterday, perhaps late yesterday, the United States should consider boycotting the upcoming Winter Games if Russian President Putin grants Snowden asylum.
Well, a lot depends on exactly what happens now. The overall impact is negative. It could be very negative. I think most likely possibility is that the Russians will temporarily let Snowden out of the airport and then perhaps give him exit documents so that he can fly to one of the countries in Central America, Bolivia, comes immediately, or Nicaragua or Venezuela come immediately to mind, and that then he will leave Russia. But still there'll be a negative impact. The question that's raised immediately is, to get out of the airport, to what extent has he had to meet with Russian security? To what extent has he had to give secrets, American secrets, to the Russians? And what particularly angers me about the whole thing, Snowden had some important things to say, but by going to Russia, and to the extent that we think that perhaps these had to deal with Soviet security people, he's undercut himself and undercut the points that he had to make. Okay, that's one case. The worst case is, of course, he stays in Russia and makes further revelations. Now, Snowden or Putin has said he has to be quiet, that he's got to be get away from politics if he stays in Russia. But it'll be a continuing thorn in U.S.-Russian relations if he stays in Russia.
Tim Hagel, your thoughts?
Yeah, I would echo those, that it's that the idea that, at least to a certain extent, that Putin has gotten part of what he would want, which is to embarrass the United States and perhaps give himself a bit of a leg up in any negotiations or discussions that he has with President Obama and so forth, or with the United States more generally. Even though Snowden was told that he had to be quiet about it, that doesn't necessarily mean that he's not going to be talking to the Soviets. And so there's always that issue as well. So we just kind of have to wait and see how it shakes out at this point. I certainly would hope that we don't boycott the Olympics over this. And I think, as the news indicated earlier, that Speaker Boehner kind of shot down that idea as a bargaining chip of some sort.
The White House's position that Snowden should be expelled and face trial in the U.S., but I wonder, does the White House really want him to face trial with all the publicity that would bring, all that that would entail, all the sympathy that he has from many people in this country as a hero? Is that something really the White House would want, Wayne Moyer?
I'm not sure that it wants it, but I think we've made a very, very strong commitment to get him back. And having been so strong in the kinds of actions that we've taken with other countries, to admit that we have second thoughts about it or to pull back from that would, I think, be embarrassing to the administration.
And the charge would be?
Well, it depends on how far we want to go. It could even be giving secrets to the enemy, which is the sort of the treason charge, to the extent that we think that he's dealt with Russian intelligence or Chinese intelligence before that. Or it could simply be breaking the law, not keeping the contract he had made with the government to keep secrets.
Right. And treason, is there still the death sentence for one convicted of treason?
It still exists. I can't imagine that it would be applied.
Mm-hmm. Microsoft pushing the U.S. Attorney General's office to approve the sharing of more information on how it handles customer data requests from national security agencies. Now, yesterday, Microsoft General Counsel Brad Smith called out government officials for failing to respond to requests to share more on the number of national security queries it receives. I'm wondering, Tim Hagel, what are your insights as why onto why tech companies want to give that information to us? Why are they complaining that they don't, they aren't allowed to?
Well, the reason they're complaining is because they're taking a pretty severe publicity hit for this, with the various companies that are accidentally releasing data, and people are realizing, hey, we didn't know you were keeping this in the first place, let alone occasionally releasing it. And now we know that with the NSA gathering information and doing its things to combat terrorism, but in the course of doing that, gathering information on a variety of citizens, that people are starting to become more aware of this. And when you see reports suggesting that whether it's Microsoft or some other company that seems to be working hand in hand with the government to pass this information off, that makes it look very bad for the company. And so they say, well, wait a minute, we want to be able to tell the public that we're only doing it under very limited circumstances and so on and so forth. And that sort of protects them from a public backlash.
Let's talk briefly about a topic that's somewhat fallen off the radar. Egypt's interim president swore in a new cabinet this week. It was a cabinet dominated by liberal and leftist politicians, and it swept away the brief era of Islamist political rule built by the country's deposed president, Mohamed Morsi. None of the 34 cabinet members belongs to the Muslim Brotherhood. Is this good news, Wayne Moyer?
I don't know whether we know for sure yet. The cabinet has a bunch of technocrats. It has a bunch of liberals. It has a bunch of secularists. And I think the big question that to me is not answered yet is, okay, these people are temporarily in alliance with the army. And will the army dominate or will these people dominate? And to the extent that these people dominate, will they attempt to bring the Muslim Brotherhood and other Muslims into the government, which at least they're making the statement that they will be open, but will they?
Mm-hmm. Well,
are open, then that will be a positive sign. Now, there's a problem is the Muslim Brotherhood doesn't want to join the government.
Right.
And so it's difficult to bring them in. But the fear that I have, and I think a lot of people have, is the army has been running the country for so long that it's going to be very hard to take power away from them.
I failed to mention that, according to reports, these 34 cabinet members, the cabinet does include three women, three Coptic Christians, making it slightly more diverse than Morsi's cabinet, I believe. Also, it's interesting to note a new Pew poll out, public interest in news from Egypt plummeting since the early week of that, our Arab Spring way back in 2011. The share of Americans saying that what happens in Egypt is very important to U.S. interests has fallen by 10 points, 46% down to 36% since 2011, February 2011. How important is what happens in Egypt to us, Wayne Moyer?
Well, I think it's terribly important. If Egypt lapses into instability, that's going to immediately raise the question of the borders between Israel and Egypt. And so an increase in violence at that level, and conceivably the breakdown of the Israel-Egypt peace treaty, which is, to the extent that there is any stability in the Middle East, that's an essential element. So stability in Egypt is a crucial national interest for the United States.
Moving on to another issue, we heard this week that Senators Rand Paul, Ted Cruz have joined an upstart effort to remove the chain of command from military sexual assault cases. The Tea Party favorites, Rand Paul and Ted Cruz, give this bill's lead sponsor, who happens to be Kirsten Gillibrand, some conservative cover in this case. Senator Grassley also this week joining a movement to improve the military's response to allegations of sexual assault among the ranks. He introduced the Military Justice Improvement Act.
The legislation would remove prosecutorial decisions from the chain of command. It would give the offices of the military chiefs of staff authority and discretion to establish courts impanel juries and choose judges to hear sexual assault cases in military courts.
Senator Grassley, a growing number of federal lawmakers calling on the military to improve its response to handling cases of sexual assault, creating some strange alliances, as we saw there, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, Charles Grassley, Kirsten Gillibrand. Why doesn't this issue break along party lines, Tim Hagel?
Well, it's kind of hard to say. Certainly what precipitated this were a couple of the high-profile cases that came up recently were the commanders of units that were supposed to be preventing or investigating these types of harassment situations, that they were the ones that were the perpetrators of the harassment. And when you have that type of chain of command in place, it makes it more difficult then to investigate and, you know, correct problems and so forth. And so in that sense, it makes a certain amount of sense to say, well, okay, let's have independent people making these decisions rather than going straight up the chain of command. But on the other side, people that may feel this is more tinkering with the military, and that's why you see that division among various folks, conservatives in particular, that say, well, look, yes, this is a problem, we need to do something, but maybe this isn't the right approach.
Mm-hmm. Your thoughts, Wayne Moyer, on this issue?
Well, one thing that should not be underestimated is just the strength that the military has in Congress in terms of influencing congressional votes. And I think it will be very hard to override the military chain of command. I think what is possible is to eliminate the authority of commanding officers to undo a verdict which has been reached by a military jury, so that if an individual is convicted, that a command will lose the authority to undo that conviction. It seems to me that was what was particularly objectionable in a couple of the instances that Tim was referring to.
Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College with us, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa with us, as we finish up this hour. Let's talk a little bit about President Obama this week recognizing an Iowa couple for their volunteer work with the 5,000th Daily Points of Light Award in a White House ceremony. The president, President Obama, introduced the couple.
About 10 years ago, Floyd Hammer and Kathy Hamilton were getting ready to retire. They had been farming for years. They had earned a break. They planned to sail around the world. And then their friend told them about a special place that they should visit along the way. In a village in Tanzania, a volunteer mission was helping to renovate an HIV/AIDS clinic. And Floyd and Kathy thought it sounded like a worthwhile detour. When they arrived in Tanzania, the country was in the third year of a brutal drought. People were starving and dying. Many of them were children. And having seen this, Kathy and Floyd simply had to do something about it. And so their vision of a leisurely retirement was replaced by a new mission, fighting global hunger. Today, the nonprofit they created, Outreach, has distributed free meals to hungry children here in the United States and in more than 15 countries worldwide. To date, more than 233 million meals. They've gotten to see many of the kids that they met in Tanzania grow up healthy and strong. And this work, they say, is the most rewarding thing that they've ever done.
President Obama at the White House speaking in honor of Floyd Hammer and Kathy Hamilton of Union, Iowa. As a program note here, they will be on our program Friday at this time on River to River. President Obama also took the opportunity to sing the praises of former President George H.W. Bush for starting a movement towards volunteerism in the U.S.
Much has been said about President Bush's own extraordinary life of service, but I'm not sure everybody fully appreciates how much he's done to strengthen our country's tradition of service. In addition to this award, he created the first White House office dedicated to promoting volunteerism, and he championed and signed the National and Community Service Act. By Washington standards, it was a modest law. It involved little money. President Bush signed it with little fanfare. But looking back, we see that it sparked a national movement. By laying the groundwork for the Corporation for National and Community Service and AmeriCorps and Senior Corps, It gave tens of millions of Americans meaningful opportunities to serve. And today, thanks to those programs and others like them, and thanks to the passion of leaders like President Bush and citizens who found the same passion over the years, volunteerism has gone from something some people do some of the time to something lots of people do as a regular part of their lives. Since 1989, the number of Americans who volunteer has grown by more than 25 million. Service is up across age groups and across regions. It's now a graduation requirement in many high schools and colleges. It's embedded in the culture of businesses, large and small.
President Obama this week in the White House singing the praises of former President George H.W. Bush. That's a moment of bipartisanship. This is a non-controversial issue, to be sure, volunteerism, but still refreshing. Tim Hagel, at a time when we don't see much bipartisanship in our federal government. Also, it brings to mind that the relationship between this president and Bush 1 and Bush 2 has been evolving in recent days, hasn't it?
It has. And, you know, even aside from with President Obama as the president, there are, you know, certain things that he can do and certain things he can't do. But what was particularly interesting was the relationship between when they were both former presidents, Bush 41 and President Clinton, and then later President Clinton and Bush 43, once he was out of office, that they both stepped forward and worked together to try to, you know, work on various service or charitable organizations. And so it was kind of very nice to see. And, of course, President Obama is now honoring the Bush 41 for, in a sense, starting or at least starting this wave of service.
And once again, we plan to have that Iowa couple from Union on this program on Friday, Floyd Hammer and Kathy Hamilton. Let's talk briefly in the last few minutes, Tim Hagel and Wayne Moyer, your views on immigration. Yesterday, President Obama, I think on four Spanish language networks, giving his view, saying that in a immigration bill without a path to citizenship for undocumented workers is not who we are as Americans. He's arguing that the House, led by the GOP, should move comprehensive immigration legislation rather than a step-by-step approach that's favored by House Speaker Boehner. I wonder, where are we now, Tim Hagel, in this? The Senate having passed a comprehensive bill for immigration reform, and the House saying it's not going to do anything of the sort.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that the Senate passed it, but the particular bill that the Senate passed is not going to be successful in that form in the House. And basically that's what we see, is that the president and the Senate, controlled by the Democrats, would like that comprehensive approach because they want the path to citizenship, which in the Republicans' view is amnesty, which they, of course, do not want. And so Boehner is saying, well, let's take it piece by piece and we can get the things that we can both agree on. But by doing that, if the Democrats were to allow that, then the things that they would agree on, the things that they don't agree on, are the real things that Democrats want, Republicans don't want. And so the Democrats would rather have, again, as we've already said, the comprehensive approach as opposed to the piecemeal approach. And so that holds up the whole process when you can't get them to agree on it even that much.
Wayne, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say the Democrats have so committed themselves to the path to citizenship, I think it'll be very hard for them to back down from it. So to sort of support what Tim is saying, I think it's going to I would like to be hopeful, and there's still a lot of political pressures building for comprehensive action, but I think the difference between the two sides over this business of a guaranteed path to citizenship is going to be a really hard one to break.
Just less than a minute left. Tim Hagel, what happened to the conventional wisdom that followed our last election that the GOP would never kill immigration reform and further risk alienating Hispanic voters?
Well, I'm not sure that everybody buys into that quite as much as they used to. But even aside from that, if they can sell it as saying, well, look, we'd like to get X, Y, and Z done, and even though it's not the whole package, at least it's something. And if they can sell that, then they can be perhaps protected.
And the issues that they can decide on, security issues –
security issues, immigration numbers in particularly in terms of getting more skilled workers to come in and so forth. Those are things Republicans are perfectly happy to pass.
Security issues, economic issues. Thank you very much for joining us this hour. Politics Wednesday, once again, has for this week moved into the past. Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Thank you both for joining us.
Welcome.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Sarah Bowden, and Emily Woodbury. Technical support from Dennis Reese, the executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, is Catherine Perkins. And joining me in the studio now, Charity Nebbe, host of Talk of Iowa. Hi, Charity.
Hello, Ben.
And tomorrow at 10 o'clock, what's on the
books?
We're
going to have a couple of fascinating personal stories. One story, Ed Krug grew up in Cedar Rapids, felt like he had a lot to prove, was great on the sports fields, and went to law school, became an extremely successful lawyer known for having a killer instinct, and then realized that he could no longer live as a man. So went through a transition and is now living as a woman. So tomorrow I'll talk with Ellen Krug about her story. We'll also talk with another transgendered individual, and we'll talk about what it means to be transgendered. We'll talk with a doctor who works with individuals who are going through this kind of transition. So fascinating stories.
Does sound fascinating. Charity Nebbe, tune in for Talk of Iowa tomorrow at 10 o'clock. Tomorrow on this program, we'll hear about invasive species. The emerald ash borer is in the news again, and there are new laws for boaters to help prevent invasive species in our waterways. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks for joining us.